In the mental health field, too often, we've made it seem as if it's just in your head. Just in your head.
The landlord can hijack the rent by 20%. That impacts people's mental health.
We can't have a profit-driven mental health care system if we want our people to be connected and healthy.
So welcome back to It's Not Just In Your Head. This is Max. And very sadly, to our dismay, Harriet is not present today because she and Professor Wolf are desperately trying to get into some new place. They've been moving to somewhere else in New York, and I guess it's like a total nightmare, and so she had to cancel last minute. So listeners, if you feel betrayed and you can't handle the podcast, if Harriet's not here, just leave now. If you are willing to move forward, then you can stay. And I'm really excited today because I have two awesome humans named Sarah and Mo. I don't even know your last names. You can say them in a minute, who are going to be talking about universal childcare as a kind of policy idea and a sort of socialist thrust that I guess Sarah's mostly been working on and Mo's here to support. But I guess before we get into that, I'm going to do the little caveat thing that we do in some episodes now as to say, well, what does this have to do with mental health? So unfortunately, in the neoliberal hellscape ideology that we're all kind of trapped in, we often think that mental health is like, me as an individual, I'm in a bad mood, I hate myself, I'm depressed, I want to die. That's a mental health issue. And we forget that everything's kind of connected within sort of the politics and the economics all around us. And so why would we be talking about childcare or universal childcare or lack of access to childcare as a mental health issue? I'm not going to run down like sociology statistics or anything, but if you just sort of think of it this way, you think, okay, there's like a single mom or a single parent, they have a couple kids, they have to work full time, they work maybe one or two jobs. Maybe they're trying to go to school so they can get a job that actually pays like maybe halfway decent money. And because of their lack of childcare, they have to run from place to place and try to kind of have like 2 to 5 jobs at once. And at that point, they're so stressed. Maybe they're abusing drugs and alcohol more often. Maybe they're like actually meeting criteria for things like PTSD, severe depression, generalized anxiety disorder. Any like clinicians listening, you could just like open the DSM at random and just like pointed a diagnosis and be like, yeah, there you go. So
I have something that I want to say about this, if that's okay.
Please. Yeah, please. Who are you, by the way?
No.
John, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm Mo. I'm a caseworker in Buffalo, New York. And so I think that you're getting into some really good stuff. We're both helping professionals, so holla. But it's true. Our fragmented healthcare system causes huge damage in perinatal and women's health in particular, I'd say. And I think that we all hear these individualistic antenatal arguments versus blaming capital and looking to class struggle politics as a solution. And I would say I know that the entire thesis of this podcast is very like Mark Fisher, but there is that sort of paragraph in Capitalist Realism where he says, capitalism requires the family for reproduction, for caring for labor power, for emotional care, even as it undermines it, it denies parents time with children. It puts enormous amounts of stress on couples as they try to pay for, exactly the things we're talking about today, childcare and healthcare and, work for a demanding employer that they're completely dependent on. So this seems obvious to me, probably to all of us, if you've like lived, worked in America, it's incredibly stressful. Of course, it'll give you depression and anxiety.
Right. And actually, I wasn't even, what's up, Sarah? You want to jump in the ring?
I was agreeing with Mo. Hi, I'm Sarah. I am a public daycare worker in Southwest Virginia. I also work as a recess aide in a Title I public school. And yeah, so where I came into this too with like the idea of this being a mental health crisis is our birth rate has decreased by 16% since 1990. Women just frankly like aren't having kids anymore, or they're having them in reduced numbers. And this is because like there is no social state like supporting women. We have almost a quarter of women are only getting 2 weeks off of their job, if they're getting that at all, for maternity leave, right? And it's not paid. And so, and then you hear these like terrible accounts of women who are even like childcare workers who work in these federally funded programs like Head Start, like they don't even get an opportunity to pump their breast milk on their job. So they're in a tremendous amount of pain and stress, even though they're the people who are being paid by the state to take care of children. So it's this like long cycle where like capital depends on these like the unpaid labor of women to keep, you know, labor in general cheap. And as a result, you have something like the lack of professionalization in childcare and the lack of like, you know, resources dedicated to public childcare, especially below the age of four in the United States. And as a result, you have, you know, tremendous poverty as well as just social issues with children because they're not getting the required socialization time that they need to have in order to learn how to like express happiness and play like, you know, like a healthy, happy kid. So yeah, we're getting parents who are crippled by debt since childcare is about $10,000 a year, and children who are addicted to screens because instead of childcare, they're latchkey and going in front of a television or Minecraft or whatever when they get home. So yeah, a lot of the unhappiness you're seeing is only a tip of the iceberg because it's only going to be a lot worse in a couple, you know, decades when once these children who've like faced the pandemic grow up and have to develop relationships without screens.
How does this not affect mental health? Like that's the better question. It's like, how does this not affect mental health? It is, it's a crisis. And, you know, just like Sarah said, it affects multiple generations at this point. We really got right into it, didn't we?
We did. Yeah. We just jumped in. Well, no, this is good. No, this is exactly, I think, what we wanted to talk. And I'm so sorry, Harriet, if you're listening later, like, cause I think this is like so Harriet's thing. Like she talks about, I mean, she's been talking about in like almost every episode, like post-World War II, here are all the changes that sort of neoliberalism like kind of caused on like the economy, therefore the family, therefore kind of everything. And so we have just like this increasingly insane like fragmentation and I wasn't going to bring this up before because I forgot it was even relevant, but for like 5 years, so out of my like grad student program and then into like community mental health, I worked at like a child abuse treatment clinic for like 5 years. I don't even know why I didn't think to bring this up. But like one thing that that we saw all the time is mostly like lower income families. And like one thing that was just that one huge barrier often was just that like sometimes parents wouldn't even like come to the clinic unless they were like either mandated by CWS or whatever, that's Child Welfare Services for listeners. Because actually going to wherever their kid was, usually school, or if they had access to daycare, like through a church or something, to the clinic, that it was just like too stressful. That like so there's also just, I think there's so many, like you were saying, Sarah, there's so many, such a sort of disrupted like safety net to where like everyone for themselves has put parents and families and single parents into this like, just like an impossible situation. And yeah, there's like a joke that we would have sometimes at the clinic where like a parent would, we had a rule where you're not supposed to leave a child unattended in the lobby, but sometimes a parent like had to go talk to the therapist one-on-one because we're often like teaching them like parenting skills and stuff because that's like arguably sometimes more important than like seeing the kid one-on-one. And then our front desk person would sort of play babysitter. You know, they're not a professional childcare worker. But most of the time, the parents would just say, like, here's my phone, just like play with my phone, right? And they'd just like sit there with the phone or the tablet or whatever forever. And like we made jokes sometimes about how like, yeah, it's like the screens are now the babysitters, right? Like that's what the screens are for. So anyway, there's just a rant sort of piggybacking on that. I also agree, I think from like an attachment perspective, I don't know if you guys are like familiar with that, but just how I think we're going to see like a really a sort of like tsunami of like disrupted attachment because of those earlier years being where like kids aren't actually sort of building the brain networks to like be interacting with humans as much as they are with screens and like not real relationships. I think it's going to actually cause a lot of longer term problems. But
yeah, Max, I think
so.
We're gonna see,
maybe we should have universal childcare.
Yeah. Well, think about it, because like
you think mirroring, face blindness.
Yeah, because with mirroring with young infants, it's super important for them to look at their mother's faces, and that's how they register emotions. Mm-hmm. And then they often repeat the emotion. It's a type of bonding. And so a lot of these kids that are below the age of five, like They're not seeing human faces. Oh, and already it's a huge problem in America where people don't like squat down to talk to children, like look them in the eye. They treat them like they're like cats or dogs. So like, I think like one of the things that you'll see is like that a lot of kids are going to be like, just have, you know, some sort of like, maybe, I don't want to say something, this might be like bullshit, oh, medicine, whatever. But like, you might see like face blindness in the future because like, because like kids are seeing adults with masks and they might have some sort of like inability to comprehend human emotion in the same way, because like it's really critical for people's like to read face skills and like face emotions and things like that.
It's really depressing. We were actually the CEO of our clinic. I just heard myself say CEO and I was like, well, that's what she was. She was a CEO. She sent out this like really long article about the research that we have so far, and actually just like pretty bad. She was like, I'm sending this to you all because it's really important. And it was just, you know, whatever. The conclusion was like kids and screen time is bad in like all the measurable, like sort of data driven ways you can say that. So, okay, whatever. Also, we weren't going to have that. We weren't going to have the podcast episode be about screen time in kids, but I guess it's just kind of gone there. So I guess like from this, maybe let's just go back to the childcare for all stuff, because I mean, it's related, obviously, that there's a deficit in access to childcare for parents, which also is because, again, Harriet would say this more eloquently than I would, but because of the fact, like the way that she's phrased it is in say like the 40s and 50s, maybe 60s, what she often calls is like a white male wage was enough to sort of like carry a whole family and you could have like stay at home mom and blah, blah, blah. And that was in part because the economic structures were what they were, right? Like you had sort of like the New Deal and you had like, you know, strong unions still in like most sort of industrial sectors and stuff. And then so as jobs are getting outsourced and automated and whatever, the economic security of families was getting worse and worse. And so now we have the situation where like both parents tend to have to work. And so what are you going to do with the kids? Well, you have to send them to school, but you know, sometimes that doesn't work out perfectly. And there's no one to like watch the kids in a lot of situations. I guess it just goes back to the screen thing and a lot of other situations, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So she's completely right. The family wage that we once knew where it could support that family unit is absolutely pretty much a fiction nowadays. And there's this book that Sarah and I both love, Birth Strike by Jenny Brown, which I think is really, really good. And actually when I first read it, I was like, oh my God, I wish I wrote this. Yeah, exactly. Because it's exactly like both of our thesis, and like we bonded over this. Like this is so great. But she makes these really good points about how you know, because of this like fragmented system of healthcare, childcare, basically neoliberalism, and the family wage being, you know, very much extinct. Families are simply responding, having to respond by having less children. You know, women are working and decision makers are trying to figure out how do we force women to take on more unpaid reproductive work while maintaining no worker control in the economy, no wealth tax. So we turn to class struggle politics. We turn to you need to enact universal programs, preferably with a unionized and well-paid workforce that can actually afford to stay in those jobs. And that's why healthcare and childcare are such huge, huge priorities. Of course, it's not the end game by any means, you know, but this is what we need right now on the terrain of neoliberalism.
Yeah, I think too, like the importance of looking at how healthcare and childcare are intertwined begins with pregnancy, because of like the sheer cost of having a baby in the U.S. is like so large that it puts parents into debt, and it puts basically children into debt before they're born because they're using their parent debt like in their life, right? So I think like having paid maternity leave and paternity leave, as well as like paid healthcare, is like really critical to getting people off the ground like with a good start.
I have to say something about pregnancy. I work with pregnant women, and some of what we were talking about sort of as we're just like bantering and like what we've all seen at work, I guess if we're sharing anecdotes, I've had two different clients during the pandemic who were heroin addicts and you know, when the pandemic hit, you know, they had been working and been able to be on medication assisted treatment, which is, you know, safe during pregnancy, much safer than just like, you know, doing heroin. And, you know, they were unaware of their pregnancy at the time, but, you know, lost their health insurance when they lost their job, start doing street heroin again because you can't get your prescription. And, you know, that's two generations affected by like a worsening habit during your perinatal period. Of course, you know, once they find out about, you know, the pregnancy, you can get on pregnancy Medicaid and see about medication assisted treatment again. But by then you've already been, you know, using for quite a while again. And I'm like, I've had this just once, just in my city here in Buffalo, twice, you know, just here in my city in Buffalo, during the past few months. I can't imagine what's happening in the entire country, but it really does. Every single thing we're doing is affecting multiple generations. It's a huge failure.
Well, let me ask you guys about like sort of what led us to the conversation, right? Like the Childcare for All work that I guess primarily you, Sarah, have been doing. So Mo, you're not allowed to talk about it at all, obviously. Yeah. Just kidding.
No, for real. I'm here to support.
I'd seen it. I mean, we can get into like how we know each other in a minute, but like I'd just sort of seen the resolution being passed around in the caucus we're in, and I was like, I don't see the Childcare for All thing happening. Like, it's not at the sort of fever pitch conversation in like Bernie wasn't, to my knowledge, he wasn't really talking about it. The Democrats tended, I mean, nobody in like the really big political spheres are talking about it much. I get, again, from what I'm paying attention to. But then when I started thinking about it more of what it would mean to actually have like universal childcare, it started to, I was like, why is this not being talked about? Like, this is so important. So I don't know, what led you, Sarah, to like care about this enough to like, I don't know, fight to push it into the DSA to try to make it like a national priority?
For sure. I was brought into the idea of like unpaid reproductive labor as a Marxist through like the Wages for Housework campaign in Italy. Like, I was researching the history of it and I thought like, oh my God, like it's so obvious that women do so much labor that's unpaid, whether it's elder care or childcare or chores around the house. And I was like, what if a solution for this was like a UBI for moms? But you can't do that in 2021 because it's just like, there's just way too much argument over like, you know, sexuality and gender, that having a UBI that wasn't like universal would be so easy stuff, it'd be so easy to like rip apart an argument like that. And so when I met Mo and I read Birth Strike, I was like, why the hell have I not been thinking about universal childcare this whole damn time? Because it is such a great idea and it would solve the same problems that Wages for Housework was asserting. And basically, like, so with universal childcare, it's a way to pay moms for the unpaid labor that they're doing through universal services. Because basically, we don't have any public after-school programs that are free. Most parents still have to pay for them, even for elementary school kids, and they amount to something like $200 or $300 a month. So there isn't any like sort of like public access for childcare for young kids other than school. And this huge hole in our system is letting, it just seems like it's such an easy thing to fix because it's so obvious and it would get so much support from both sides of the aisle because, you know, churches provide a lot of free childcare because there's a need for childcare. And churches are also like, at least where I live, they're within walking distance of houses for this reason, so that you can walk your kids to the childcare facilities there. And like, we need to find a state way of like fixing the like sort of like absent sort of, I don't know, absent resources that we don't have. And so coming up with like universal childcare, I was first directed to it through the book Birth Strike by Jenny Brown. And it's important because it discusses the Swedish model for universal childcare and its history and how it was developed. And if you don't know about like Sweden, you might think something like universal childcare is impossible, right? But it's very possible. And like, it happens with a couple in the 1930s. I'm not going to try and pronounce their names because they're Swedish, but like they introduced childcare because of the declining birth rate. There was a panic about the Swedish government of over how we're going to pay for social services, like social security type deals that are paid for out of like the working people's tax money that they pay like on an everyday basis. So yeah, I got into childcare basically because I was looking for something to solve the solution, the problem of like, why is labor unpaid for women? Because personally, it affects me greatly. And I see a lot of women who are struggling with it. Like, there's a woman in my local who has a 2-year-old boy, and she's paying $950 a month for childcare for her kid. And this is like, she's doing a really good job because she's like picking the best place possible, and she's paying an entire paycheck in order to do this. Like, one of her paychecks goes for like a month of tuition, and she's advocating for like paid maternity leave for her teacher by, she's like raised funds to give her teacher, her son's teacher, like a maternity leave because the woman had a baby and like had to come back after 2 weeks, which is the case for all of these workers. And so like seeing like all these people around me that have this like huge need, even though I don't personally have kids, like I want to have kids. I feel like I can't have kids because I know how expensive it is. And I live paycheck to paycheck because I'm a childcare worker. Mm-hmm. So it all came to fruition, after joining the caucus, and it was passed as a priority for the caucus. And I thought, like, what better way to like, you know, organize than to like advance Marxist politics alongside something I think would attract many people into socialism if they understood that not only is it possible, which is proven because of Sweden, but also like it's desirable. Like, you really do want to have universal childcare because if you read the studies, it'll level income inequality over generations. And it also like it increases the happiness for mothers and for kids. And like those critical years where kids are developing, if they're left alone, it prevents them for the rest of their lives from being able to have like, be able to draw on happiness as like something they can like experience because of neglect. So yeah, like, I guess that's kind of a long-winded way of saying how I got here. But yeah, since then I've been involved primarily in trying to advance like Child Care for All as an initiative within the DSA. I believe in like universal childcare. Because, and I don't necessarily use the word preschool because I don't think that, like, it has to be within a school. I think that there's other countries, like Denmark has about, like, 20% of its schools for elementary students. They're in the forest. They're called forest schools, and they have universal childcare too. So I think, like, school or preschool isn't necessarily the right word we need to be using because daycare can be provided through, as a way of providing universal childcare. You could expand play-based daycare. And that, I think, yeah, so that's just all around different things.
And I mean, you've touched on this as, you know, part of like why we started talking. You know, we love like families and babies and all that good stuff. But part of this is
family values.
Oh my God, stop. So part of this is a labor issue because childcare workers are the lowest paid profession in the States. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit, you know, on the social investigation that you've been doing. Are we able to talk about this on the podcast?
Yeah. It's been an interesting. So I originally wanted to salt the childcare industry, and I was going to do it by myself, basically.
Wait, can you say what that means? Just like, not all our listeners are like super sort of entrenched leftists. So what does like salting mean?
Yeah, so salt is when you go into a place, like a workplace, in order to unionize it, whether through a formal union or through informal workers' committees. And I have my boyfriend, he runs this organization called Target Workers Unite. And so I started, like, I wanted to do something, what he does with Target, I wanted to do it with a large corporate childcare center that I'm not going to name in case I do it in the future. But as you might know, Max, I do a lot of tenant union work, and one of the mobile home parks, many people live below the poverty line in these like massive trailer park, like they expand over the entire mountainside, and so there's hundreds and hundreds of tenants there. And while I was like door knocking over the summer for a safety petition inside this like shithole trailer park where there was literally a sewage pipe dumping out into the children's playground that we got fixed as a tenants union. while I was door knocking, there were all these signs that were like, childcare, hiring for aides, like childcare aides. And on one sign it said the starting wage for janitors was $13. And then another sign said childcare workers, the starting wage was $12. And I was like, what kind of like what kind of shady business is this? So I decided instead of salting a corporation, I would salt the public school system instead. I followed these signs from the trailer park to a, like the next day I went to a job fair where I was sat in front of like three different elementary school principals, and they were like, "So can you talk to children?" Well, I think so. I had very limited previous experience with children. I had only been a nanny for my landlord, actually. And then before that, I had in high school gone on a mission trip to Haiti or something. And like, that's like, for me, I was like, okay, I haven't done any childcare since then, really. But I decided to get hired, and this was in September, and it was during the pandemic. And so I went through part of the emergency worker training through the DSA and through the IWW, basically learning like how to map your workplace, how to talk to your coworkers about unions. And I thought like, okay, I can do this. And I did not realize how difficult this would be because of how high the turnover is for childcare, just because it's such an awful job and it's so exhausting. That like a lot of my coworkers, like, so in the first 3 months when I started working and during the pandemic, they had us working inside the school system used the money from the CARES Act to open public daycares. And they did this by hiring lunch recess aides. But of course, there's no lunch or recess because school was closed. But school was never really closed. What the school system did was like let the teachers stay home. And instead, it erected these daycares and hired low-wage workers from the trailer parks in order to staff them. And so I found myself in a situation where I was working inside of a high school cafeteria with 12 kids a day from a mixed age group, from an elementary school that's a Title I elementary school. So that means 40% of the children live below the poverty line. And my days were crazy. We had no breaks. And when I tried asking for breaks, people were like, "Wait, what do you mean like breaks?" Like, there is just like so unheard of within the industry to even like get breaks that like people were like not sure how to even go about it. So what we did was like, I ended up talking to all my coworkers and we wrote a petition together demanding a wage increase, breaks, and to basically to follow the public school system schedule because we were working on days when the schools were closed. And in turn, like, we got a 3% raise that the whole school system got, and it amounted to only $100 more a year. And then we got 2 15-minute breaks, but they're unpaid. So like my work day instead has been extended beyond my contract because I'm getting breaks now, which is crazy, right? And then, yeah, so, and then we're still working on the days when the teachers don't work and when the schools are closed. And there's been no reporting. Like, my students have gotten COVID. My coworkers have gotten COVID. I had no contact tracers ever reach out to me. No management from the school tell me about this type of thing. And we had no supplies either. I had to, like, I would write all these, like, lists of, like, things I need and submit them through all, like, the formal processes and never get anything back. So it's just been an extremely like daunting process because all the women that signed the petition have already quit. Because so I'm like basically the only one left from this small organizing committee that I managed to form in the first 6 months of the job. But now schools have reopened. So instead of being inside the high school cafeteria, where I'm back to being a recess aide. And I'm trying to work with like figuring out how to communicate with teachers because now I'm seeing teachers for the first time. And I can talk to them about their students because I know them better than they do because I've been with them the whole year. And like, I'm, you know, trying to tell them about my situation too. I'm like, I'm not getting any breaks still. I'm like, you know, paying for all the supplies myself. And, you know, it's been, you know, a very difficult task. I think like when I approach it again, because I plan on salting again for at least another 2 years, I don't think I'm going to continue salting the public school system just because like the business union that I am getting people to join is so ineffective. It's part of the NEA. Which is the largest labor union in Virginia, but it's a business union for teachers. And so I'm thinking like, I'll try again, but do something closer to like what Target Workers United is doing, which would be through like making like a corporate brand, like blank Care Workers Unite. I'm not going to say which corporation because I need to get the job first, but like, you know, that's just how I think of labor organizing is basically you have to do it on your own. I watch my partner do it so tirelessly. And I've learned about like filing NLRB charges and all of that. It's just so hard on your own. So part of this call is also me being like, okay, does anyone like want to help me? Because I could use another childcare worker or someone who's like willing to do this. Because the point would be to like unify people, like childcare workers, so that we can like nationalize the childcare industry on the behalf of workers, because we need to make the like the conditions better. You can't just like if we were to pump money into the daycare industry right now, it would expand those services, but workers are so exploited. I don't think that that's even like a good idea. I think it's better to like, you know, maybe like unionize these childcare workers, demand better pay, better rights, breaks, basic things that like other workers in professional, more professionalized industries have. But yeah.
So you just went on like a socialist torpedo from like childcare for all down to like labor organizing methods, and then interconnected them all like in like this. So anyway, I'm just like blown away. So you're like,
yeah, this is, there's a word for it. There's a word. Sorry. It's called whole worker organizing. That's just like someone came up with to describe it.
Right. Did Jane McAlevey come up with that? I don't know if that's, or maybe it's just been around. I don't know.
I have no idea.
So, because what you're kind of like mapping out here is like, you're not just saying childcare for all is a good thing that we should, everybody listening to the podcast and people in general who think that like, I don't know, kids matter or moms or parents matter or families matter or something, have strong family values, that people shouldn't just like generically say, yeah, childcare for all sounds good. You're saying that you've been sort of in the trenches for a while, like as a childcare worker, and sort of seeing the effects, like seeing both from like the worker perspective of like as a childcare worker who's sort of being underpaid and exploited, and the working and the living conditions of like the parents and families and workers like in your area, sort of having a really relatively severely impacted quality of life because there isn't really access to high quality universal childcare, right? So I guess I'm just kind of like mapping that out because it sounds like your personal story led you to kind of see this broader vision of how like if we could actually build enough unification around this, this would like enormously improve quality of life for people.
Yeah. And I think any person who wants to organize for an issue, like they should involve themselves in labor organizing around that issue. Like Mo is a great example because she's doing all the social work for around like prenatal care and adoption and things like that. So I feel like she's actually a great expert on Medicare for all. And that's why if you want to be able to write or talk about something or organize for something, I highly recommend that people, your listeners, they actually do the work and, you know, like whether that be working in the health industry or working in the childcare industry, it's super important that you do that so that you can fully understand like how this system is fucking up. And it's also such a complex system because it's not nationalized that there's just like so many patchwork things coming together. Like you have partial coverage through subsidies from the state, like things like Head Start, which in Virginia, there's also this thing called the Virginia Preschool Initiative, which covers about 20% of children who are four. And like it does what you were saying, and it like requires parents take these classes in order to have their kids be able to access this public daycare. And so I think like being able to understand even that these things are like these public options are really bad. I only know that because I've been interviewing Head Start workers and comrades in my tenants union have been as well. So it's, you really have to dig in order to know how truly gruesome it is.
No, it's true. Like public, childcare options being configured as It's such a gruesome way to put it, but it's the way that like bureaucrats, think of it. Configuring them as poverty programs make them just like targets for, you know, the budget cutters in charge. And I think that Sarah's experience as well as just, you know, I think what we're trying to like illustrate here is that this isn't just, you know, okay, we read about it, no, we care about it. It's like, no, you have to get into it and talk to people about it and make it your life too. You're actually seeing the divisions between, you know, people who really should and could be pretty aligned on this, like parents versus childcare workers versus teachers. It seems so clear that, you know, all of these people should be allied, but, you know, teachers already have, you know, their public schools and unions and, parents, you know, are pitted against child care workers because they're, paying so much, like, personally for their childcare because of the you know, the crisis that we're in, where childcare is, you know, marginal and privatized and sort of corporatized in a lot of cases. And there's just not enough allyship with these workers, and not enough unity behind this issue.
I met Sarah and Mo through a DSA caucus called Class Unity. And the to my understanding, the sort of accusation is it's a bunch of class reductionists who are like cannibalistic baby killers or something. I don't really understand fully what it is. But like, my understanding is, I mean, I guess what attracted me to it was like we're Marxists trying to do like class struggle politics. And I was like, I'm into labor and tenant organizing, and I think that sounds cool. So
yeah, so that's how we met. We met Max this way, Sarah and I met this way. All three of us met this way. And yeah, we're part of the Class Unity Caucus in DSA. I help run membership for the caucus. So I actually know these people pretty well, large amount of people. And yeah, Max, the way that you so beautifully put it, you know, and any sort of and any sort of charges like that, which I can't say that I've heard, they really just don't stack up. I'm somebody who probably spends more time around class reductionists than anybody because of, you know, my role in the caucus. And I'm just like, oh, okay, so these people are, you know, just wonderful, focused people who, you know, care about childcare and healthcare and labor. I think that, you know, if people want to know more about the caucus, we have shared principles of prioritizing class politics over identity politics, material politics, you know, so mass politics over symbolism, and activist subculture, as well as, you know, defining DSA and orienting DSA as a workers' party. And pretty much the only place that I've ever heard people talk about in very, very like strategic labor organizing and strategic electoral organizing to the level that we do is within this caucus. And we do have like an organizing requirement. You are required to, you know, engage with Marxist political education to organize, whether in, you know, like Max and Sarah, housing and education, or in healthcare and labor. We really want people to be, you know, educating themselves, like developing their ideology, engaging in ideological and class struggle. And we have true hopes that the Democratic Socialists of America will become a mass org. I think that we could. So that's why we're bringing resolutions to the overall convention in 2021 in hopes that it'll make it easier to get some of these sort of projects off the ground, like childcare work groups. So I organize for Medicare for All. That's pretty straightforward because there's a legislation, there's a champion for it, you know, Bernie, and it's something that we can do on a couple different levels. There's even, you know, some statewide organizing going on that, depending on where you live. I think Max and I probably both know about that. But for something like childcare, there's not as easy of a blueprint because liberal policy around childcare that tends to get attention and tends to get like people revved up is like, okay, well, we're going to create a task force to investigate this issue. You know, the same old shit. Or it's you know, foundation funded politics that, you know, is an existential threat to socialist organizing because it's ostensibly coming from the 1%, and I don't want their social change. And I think that what Sarah is bringing forward, you know, what all of our resolutions are bringing forward, is really, really necessary because we need this organizing coming from a member funded, you know, mass organization. So it's, you know, people banding together, mm-hmm. not from any sort of like outside funding. So that's why the source. Right. The source DSA is really important, and that's our hopes for DSA is to have this be, you know, a mass and materialist oriented organization with Marxist politics.
And so the resolution that you, I guess you had written, Sarah, or you'd put forward, the Child Care for All resolution, I think just passed within Class Unity, right? So that means it's...
Yeah, it was the most popular one, too.
We're allowed to talk about that,
right? Oh, for sure.
Okay. Yeah, so it was like the... Yeah, I looked at the percentages. So it was like the most... It was the most voted... Well, I don't know. Well, let's check, see if we need to edit it out. Like, yeah, we're allowed to talk about it, right?
Yeah. Oh, I'm on the central committee. We voted. Yeah, we could talk about it.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, like, I don't know actually how sort of internal DSA stuff works. I stayed away from it for a long time. So I think
all three of us did.
Really? Well, it was the stuff, what drew me to the caucus was the languaging about the subcultures. There was like so much sort of like what I felt like, I guess I don't want to offend listeners, but sort of like college kids subculture stuff is, I guess, the way I'll say it. Or I mean, what Catherine Liu would probably call like the PMC stuff, right? That I was just like, I don't really want to. And I think in part, just maybe I'll just elaborate just a tiny bit, is that I think like having worked in community mental health with like a lot of poor people or a lot of like lower income people and people of like an extremely diverse set of backgrounds, and then doing a lot of like labor organizing and now tenant organizing, now just finding like how much, like if you just randomly select like a sort of an ordinary person in any workplace or like apartment building, or whatever, like most people don't know all the language and stuff. And like the stuff that I think like sort of like activist college kid types get sort of like angry at people for like not using the right, like knowing what the right sort of cultural rituals are and stuff. And I think I had like a really almost traumatizing like unlearning experience from realizing that of just like, man, most people don't talk like that or their cultural norms are not that way and stuff. And I was like, well, like, wait, what have I been doing? Why was I taught to do that? And so, so I guess I'm just saying that, and especially like listeners who are like extremely online leftists, like I think some people just don't understand, like they're in a subculture, like they're in a sort of like insular, and they can call it inclusive, but it's not inclusive if like kind of regular, ordinary working class people like have no idea what you're talking about or have no interest in like listening to you or whatever.
At the same time, if you don't agitate for things that are like, you know, controversial or unpopular, they'll never become uncontroversial and popular. Just sort of like workaday socialist politics. So I think, I don't know that I have like too big of a problem with that, or it's definitely not like the most important of our unifying principles. But it's definitely something that like draws. I think what you're saying is important because it draws people to the caucus, and then you get sucked into, oh, I'm reading Kautsky now, and it's really I'm connecting with people who can develop my understanding and things. I think the problem is, I think what you're saying, I relate to in that when people get like indignant or institutionalize those norms rather than just be like, oh, this is sort of how we do it. Cause then you get outside of that space and it's just not how people act. But yeah, I think that there's a strategic value to us having that as part of our, you know, unifying principles, because it draws people in who are like, yes, I want to talk about class struggle. Can I do that with you guys? And can I learn about, you know, the history, with you guys? And yeah.
I guess I should have said too, that was just the reasoning for why I had sort of stayed away from DSA, because I just felt like, oh, those are the vibes I'm getting, and I don't really want to like, that doesn't like, I guess like culturally feel good anymore. Like maybe when I was like in college, when I was younger, it felt like kind of cool, but like I didn't really want to be involved anymore. So anyway, I don't know really much about the internal DSA politics stuff. So I don't really know how it works from like, Sarah, you getting the Child Care for All resolution passed, or I mean, the caucus getting it passed, and then like kind of what happens next.
Let me talk for a second. I've made things up in my head.
Like, oh, it goes to the DSA natural. Yeah, please.
So like this caucus like is really important because for me, what prevented me from wanting to join the DSA is that there's many people who are in the DSA who are DNC staffers. And I am like against that. And there's nobody in our caucus who's like that. And that's just changes the environment. You have people who are actually productive and looking to organize or Marxist principles. And the caucus has been super helpful with helping develop me as a political organizer. Like early on, before, I guess last summer, people from the caucus connected me with organizers from Portland's Up Now campaign. And so I got to hear about like the work that they were doing to organize for universal preschool in Multnomah County, or however it's pronounced, I'm across the country. But like they were successfully in November through a direct ballot petition, like they gathered signatures and got it on their ballot to have universal preschool through the DSA. It was collaborating with labor unions and doing all this great work. And seeing that pass in November after I'd already talked with these people, like I was more excited about that part of the election than I was about the general election. Like I was more excited about Oregon's state legislation than I was about the presidency. And so now like the goal of this, like for me, I'm a co-chair now for the New River Valley, Virginia DSA. We're a brand new chapter. Class Unity helped me like develop the chapter and like helped me like feel confident enough to go in and be like, yeah, I can, you know, I'm an organizer too. I'm already organizing for universal childcare. And I still think that in spite of all these social things that the DSA has among it from the PMC class, that the DSA is still somewhere that the working class turns to. And I have proof of it, which is that there's like, within our childcare for all work group, we have sanitation workers, childcare workers, like that kind of thing. Like there is still working class people within the DSA. And it's just about developing those relationships and like figuring out a way to organize towards something that's like a statewide public goods campaign, which is what I think that this resolution does. Because in places like Portland, you can gather signatures and for a certain district and pass legislation for a district that institutes a progressive income tax or top income tax. And you can do that only in certain places. Like you can't do that in Virginia where I live. You can only do statewide campaigns because of this thing called Dillon's Law, which prevents local governments from having laws that are different from state law. So you can't have a progressive income tax for Montgomery County that would fund after school programs or public childcare. Instead, it would have to be a statewide campaign. And so as an organizer, I was like, okay, Portland's like, they did a great job, but it was a little bit of a different task, right? Because all they had to do was figure out the tax base for a county. Whereas for me, I would have to figure out the tax base for Virginia, which is an enormous state, and the very varied like demographic sort of shift where like I live in Appalachia, but Northern Virginia is like basically a different country. And what this resolution would do would be to provide a paid staffer through the DSA who can help me calculate a progressive income tax and legislation for my state. And I think that this is actually a strategy that other DSA locals can and should take on because of Portland's success. Like, not only can I like use like a resolution like this to produce childcare legislation, but you could in California too, Max. And like, I think that's what we need is like, we need things that can like, people get their most energy out of canvassing and from talking to actual working class people and getting their boots on the ground. And like, I want something with the end of the Bernie campaign. I want something new. And so that's what I've spent the last year working for. Like if Bernie had been the presidential candidate, I would have been working for like, you know, to advance his campaign. But instead we got this timeline where I had to invent a campaign myself.
No, it's true. Yeah. We need like a professional revolutionary economist. You know, it's weird, but we do. And there's an example right here in like Western New York that I think is also sort of like analogous to like what was going on in Portland and their success there. But it's the same thing here. And Sarah knows this, but we can't do like ballot initiatives like if I wanted to here in Buffalo either for something like ranked choice voting or like a universal childcare program. So there has to be like a way to coordinate statewide, and that's pretty difficult to do. And there actually was through this campaign called Tax the Rich, led by the people down in New York City DSA, where they led this statewide effort to just get normal people and normal organizers to intervene in the state's annual budget decision process. It'll be officially done at the end of this month because, you know, by the state's constitution, they have to release their budget then. So we organized in January and February about laying this foundation to basically democratize our state's economy because it's such a haven for crony capitalism here. The population center is completely down in New York City, and you know, there's this untaxed financial sector, this corrupt Governor Cuomo. The top 5% have gotten richer every single year. And I live over in Western New York in Buffalo, and the infrastructure and the social programs here are absolutely paying the price. So we started, we got on board with it, and we're like, oh my God, this is amazing, you know, that your chapter has people in it who are tax lawyers and people who can write legislation. You know, it's basically where the headquarters of the organization are, and has the most, you know, professional infrastructure because there's so many electeds down there. So they could actually write this infrastructure that creates a progressive income tax system for the state, taxes investment income, taxes wealth, and amends the constitution to allow a wealth tax and taxes inheritances, as well as, you know, the financial sector and big business. And we really, really need that because, like, over the past decade, New York has become, you know, the most unequal state. And it's one of the lowest in public education equity. I work in hospitals, one of the lowest in public hospital safety. And it really needs, you know, a massive increase in public investment. But there just aren't these updated revenue racers being proposed. Mm. So I saw, like, a downstate chapter that had a lot of resources benefit an upstate chapter that really doesn't, multiple upstate chapters that really don't, by being able to write legislation and get people to mobilize on it. And it's like, oh my God, we could be doing this so many more places by having a position like this that can run public good campaigns. Like, what we need to do is mobilize, and, you know, we're just regular, like, working people, were totally fine at that. You know, we'll educate ourselves on that and educate each other on that. But the technical details, it's a whole other task, and most people just aren't living in places where they have like access either statewide or in their county, wherever the change needs to take place on a municipal or state level, to be able to make something like this. So we need to make it.
Absolutely.
I don't know how much longer y'all were able to stay on, but, like, I mean, some of, like, Harriet's questions, we didn't really get into them. I kind of wanted to ask you a couple of them, unless it felt like too wonky, but you guys are kind of stepping toward the wonky stuff. And, like, the importance of, like you're saying, a sort of professional economist person.
Well, can we talk about the resolution? And, I guess Sarah basically did, but I think that that's the sort of track that we were on, where it's like, okay, so we have this resolution that will, like, create a position for DSA.
You can look at the example of, like, DSA's Medicare for All campaign. They have beautiful graphics and toolkits that are ready so that new chapters can, like, instantly adopt a Medicare for All campaign. And my goal would be to, like, have something easy and accessible like this created, as well as providing a staffer who can spread, like, the word about this sort of strategy that I talked about, where different states or different counties, depending on your laws, can advance universal childcare through their legislation, depending on the, like, you know, legal situation there. And it would also, like, provide resources that people can apply for financial stuff. So, like, you could say, like, okay, like, we need this sort of, like, money to, like, have a canvassing materials made. You could apply for it that way. Because right now you just see, like, there's no, if you Google Child Care for All, there isn't really a DSA campaign still. And if you were to, like, look through the last 2 years of the National Committee's minutes, childcare is never mentioned once. In fact, like, childcare passed, the DSA passed a childcare resolution in 2019 that would have provided something like $60,000 towards childcare, and not a dollar has gone towards it. It was also supposed to create a paid staffer for that resolution as well. And there is no paid staffer. So at first, when I discovered that, I felt like I discovered, like, a big, like, QAnon conspiracy. I was like, all right, the DSA is passing things and doing nothing. But as it turns out, it's just kind of, this is why we have to have a caucus that's reorganizing the DSA to prevent this sort of mistake from happening again. Because I don't want to do all this effort and then not have any money ever go towards childcare. Oh my gosh, my weird woodman neighbor, he just pulled into my driveway with a car full of wood. Okay, But it's okay. I'm going to keep talking.
I think what you ended up hearing about that last resolution when, you know, we were looking at the emails from who passed it, it was sort of based on like organizer burnout, right? And so I think that the teamwork that something like a caucus provides, and the fact that we as a caucus prioritize like healthcare, like my organizing, and childcare, like your organizing, as well as principled accountability-based electoral organizing and strategic labor organizing, means that like no matter what issues you come up against, you have people you can lean on who care about the same thing, who it's like, oh my God, help me untangle this and figure this out, or can I delegate this to you? We need to push on this, because you know, no, just getting something like this passed is, it feels like that's the victory. But then you actually have to push to get everything made. And there's going to be so much, risk of burnout, because it's a lot of work. But I think that it's worth it to have member-funded campaigns to tax the wealthy all across the country and fund universal child care. The way that we have, you know, work groups popping up all over the country to push for universal healthcare. It really does go hand in hand. We need it. We really need it. And we have an organized group of people behind it pushing for it.
Yeah.
Something that kind of excites me about it too is that it's in a similar way that things like healthcare for all, or just general kind of tenant or labor organizing kinds of efforts, can just sort of reach new people that weren't necessarily involved before. And maybe it's not that they didn't care, but nothing had like met them where they're at to say like, hey, that thing that you care about or are worried about all the time, like, do you want to get involved in the thing? And that something like universal childcare speaks to so many, you know, moms and like parents and families that it almost seems like nobody's talking about, or at least like socialists in the, I don't know, the like very visible socialists aren't really talking about. So it excites me to think that like if this did go through and there's like this sort of paid staff person within the DSA, and it just sets up a flurry of campaigns around the country, there's just a lot more like organizing potential for like more ordinary people to get involved with something that like improves their lives and everybody else's lives. So
The rich, we had like meetings, and we canvassed and phone banked and everything in Buffalo, and when we were holding like meetings about like what would it mean to you to tax the rich, why are we pushing for this, childcare and education like consistently come up. This is just like a deeply felt need. And so I think that, you know, it, of course, it's not the end game of socialist organizing, but right now we need to tax obscene wealth. We need to tax the financial sector and big business. We need to put the economy towards the public good, where workers have more control. And we need to democratize the economy because it's pretty much run by like free market corporations. The solution is, of course, for working people to control their workplaces, their governance, their lives in the first place. But this is where we're at right now, and this would be a solid punch on capital, I think.
Totally. I think it would also help families who want to prepare for a mass strike eventually as well. Because a lot of times, like in these like neighborhoods, like I know it sounds like out there, right? But like if you were to sustain, if you look at the West Virginia teacher strike, like their women were providing childcare for the teacher strike, because that's a basic need that people have. It's like, so if you have something like universal childcare, you would increase the free time of workers so that they can agitate against their government and against capital, right? And so part of that too would be like if you know, having childcare for specific, like in a state where you can have all these workers that are, you know, totally immiserated in their living conditions, like it frees up their ability to change those living conditions. Because a lot of times women that I know, like at Target and stuff, like they're not going to go on strike because they have to feed their kids or else, right? It's like, it's a matter of like them being able to feed their kids dogs or not. So like, do you want your kid's dog starving to death? No, you keep going to work, right? So like, I don't know. I think childcare is a way that we can have a solution for like, it provides a technical solution for like, you know, like why don't we see like workers willing to go on strike, other than the fact that there's very horrifically low unionization rates in the United States? Like, I think a lot of it too is like people cannot simply put themselves at risk because like they have to watch out for their family.
It also, it makes a universalist demand of a class that benefits from all of this reproductive work that it goes completely uncompensated and in fact is pushed off completely under the family unit and the family unit's dependence on the employer. We should be insulted by the way things are.
Oh yeah. Every day.
And the way that like the family unit has just been sort of like crumbling, like collapsing internet on itself over the last like 50 to 70 years. Like the expectation that like the family is supposed to take care of X, Y, and Z when the family just isn't what it used to be, right? Because of the economic structures that don't allow the quote unquote family to do any of the things it's expected to do. So it's just, it's ridiculous, but it's, and I guess this is, you know, the joke you made before, Mo, of like the Family Values Caucus or whatever that like,
that, I feel like you made that joke and I laughed bitterly at it.
Well, because it's like cute. What? Well, I mean, because I guess the sort of American right, like the all the talk they have about family, it doesn't make any sense. But like, you know, Harriet has actually said something a couple times is just this like flyby idea of like, you know, the left needs to reclaim the family, and it's just like a random thing she said, but it's actually kind of a good point. I mean, families are going to continue to be around. You know, I don't really think the sort of like abolish the family thing that like 10 people are talking about is like ever going to quite catch on.
You're gonna have to have me on for another episode on that because will take us completely off track if we start talking about that. But I do just want to say yes. Just want to say yes, Harriet is completely correct there. I don't see how we can call this dependence on the employer pro family or even how we can call it freedom or choice at all. We should be insulted by, you know, the lack of paid leave, the lack of childcare, the lack of healthcare, and we absolutely need to, and you know, are mobilizing against it. These resolutions don't just relate to, one facet of our organizing. You know, Max, you wanted to at least boost that we also have an Amnesty for All resolution, and I'm bringing forward a single transferable vote resolution, which I think would go a huge way in representation and transparency and in the DSA, as well as there's a Spanish translation for all resolution that would make the process of Spanish translation for DSA a lot more clear and accountable. Do you want to talk about any of those that I've laid out? Just give a quick little boost, give it a whirl.
Sure. I mean, I could spend like a really small amount of time on the Amnesty for All one, but I don't know. Or if, I mean, you actually might know more about it than I do. I have like a kind of cool story about it, but
tell us
if you want to talk about the single transferable vote. Yeah.
Okay. No, let's keep it about organizing. Yeah, please.
Yeah. So, okay, sure. So, I mean, actually I like this story because, well, that's actually a really messed up story, but so in the tenant organizing that I'm involved in with like most of my free time, we ran into an issue where, let's see, how do I say it concisely? Landlord is being a total scumbag and it turned into like death threats against the tenant and, like really kind of really extreme stuff that we completely did not expect. And we were ready to, we tried to go the ordinary routes of like, okay, the landlord has broken this law and that law. And we're talking to this, we're not doing any like fiery direct action. We're just going to like follow the rules and stuff. And like, we did that and nothing happened, of course. And then it went to like, on this one day, the tenant just got lucky. Cause they used to actually be kind of friends with the landlord. Used to be on really good terms. And they saw the landlord on the property. They were just there and it's kind of weird. And this tenant is just like super bold. And he was like, I'm just going to try to sit down with the guy and like try to negotiate with him. Cause we've done the like lawyer, we did like the demand letter thing to the lawyer after we reported this thing to the city and crap. And then the landlord was like, blah, 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 blah. I know hitmen, death threats. And then it went back and forth a couple other times. It turned into like, I'm going to call ICE on you cause I know you're undocumented. And from there, the organizing just had to stop. Like, cause the guy, as bold as this guy was, he was just like, okay, so I'm out just so you guys know, like I'm in, and it's funny because he's like, I'm in illegal. And we're just like, you know, we're like, don't call yourself that. And he's like, well, I'm an illegal. And so we're like, what the fuck? So what are we going to do now? Right. And he's just like, you know, I looked it up and like, you just go to the ICE website and you press a fucking button and then somebody can come for you. And like, he took the, he and his family like took the numbers off of the door of the, where they live. Cause they were just like, well, what if they come for us? And like, they've been living in like serious fear since this. Like all he was trying to do was just like increase his quality of life. Cause there was just like these like drunk tourists coming every day from like an Airbnb, that's like illegal. It shouldn't be there. Anyway, this turned into a lot of, lengthier conversations and us just realizing that like the widespread issue of the number of undocumented, tenants and workers in the United States who are, you know, from a sort of Marxist perspective, like they are producers of value that capitalists are, you know, that are accumulating through exploitation of those workers. And so the sort of border system and the immigration enforcement systems within the US are, like everything else, they're sort of hegemonically created to accumulate capital. And so we thought, you know, we can't do some of the basic stuff we want to do in tenant organizing as long as there's that wedge there, that like folks are undocumented and there's nothing we can do about it. Like that's a federal level thing. Like you can do all the sort of like hashtag abolish ICE rhetoric you want, but it's not going to do anything. So, so I was talking with, somebody else in Class Unity and my ex housemate, who's also a member and like works on, he's like doing a PhD in sociology and he's super, super, his whole thing is like studying immigration. And he actually had like a Jacobin article published a couple of years ago that was about how the Democrats has become pretty right wing on immigration. They've moved toward what he describes as moving from like a sort of amnesty for all kind of conversation towards something called pathway to citizenship, which is basically just like a whole bunch of really messy bureaucratic means tested crap that just like is it's very, the way he describes it, it's like harmful to immigrants for the most part. And so he was saying like, you know, socialists need to like move toward amnesty for all. So I kind of like told this story to a couple people in the caucus. And then he just like whipped up the resolution like right away. He's like, there we go, amnesty for all. And I guess it just went through some other, I didn't really have much other, like much involvement beyond that. I just kind of like told the story about what we were dealing with from a tenant organizing perspective. And I think to my knowledge, it just generated a lot of discussion and it felt like it was sort of aligned with the sort of Marxist values within the caucus that resulted in the resolution, which was just voted as a, I don't know if it's considered a priority or something that will be sent to national. So I thought, like, for me, it actually was really like, empowering for any listeners that are like still listening this far into it, just to say, like, I didn't realize that you can, that that's how it can work, right? That you just, like, you can have conversations that stem from your on-the-ground organizing that can result in, like, pushes within DSA that could actually potentially make, like, really widespread change, potentially, right? There's no guarantee that the resolution will have any significant impact, but... I was really amazed to just sort of watch the process unfurl as it did. So, yeah.
What a great story. Yeah, and he, you know, your roommate, he also, he added the first line to our childcare resolution. Like, cause I asked for edits from our caucus and he helped make it seem like a sensible resolution. It had a beginning after he looked at
He's
it.
He's a really good writer. Yeah, he is. He has like a really smart, like writer brain. He's really good with that.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's amnesty for all. So that was just to me, that's really exciting. I also, I mean, I think too, maybe just to speak on that, anyone that's listening, that's like Class Unity is class reductionists, that like, it's like, I think he and I had talked about, like, it's interesting because we're not talking about this as an identity thing, like the identity of an immigrant or the marginalized identity of so-and-so. It was like, this is it's like a sort of labor and worker and class struggle issue, which arrives at the same thing that I think certain people might want to arrive at from saying like, to talk about, I don't know, maybe diversity, more diversity centered conversations, like the liberal conversations. So I just also just thought that was interesting. And that most people that sort of think of CU as like a class reductionist caucus might be surprised to see like something that's literally just trying to give like all undocumented immigrants immigration status, or quote unquote legal documentation. I think some people would be surprised to see that. So
no, yeah, that status does, and your story illustrates it, does so much harm to organizing against landlords, against bosses. And I think it's a really important stance to take. It takes a strong materialist stance on something that's often viewed as a cultural issue. And I think that's extremely important. and just well done. So yeah, I love both of these resolutions. I love all of ours. And honestly, I love class unity. I do.
I hope people listen to this and join. That's, you know, because we like these conversations. Like, I think like my life has certainly been changed by the caucus for the better. And I think Max, you'd say so too. And like, this is, it's been a way for me to like,
yeah,
meet other people who are like-minded, which is very difficult when you live literally in the middle of nowhere, like I do. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the class reductionist, you know, pejorative that you were just talking about, Max, like when I look around, at my comrades, like here in Buffalo, where, you know, the caucus has seats on steering and has voting power, and we've been very much like trying to, well, we've successfully like steered the chapter towards strong healthcare organizing around Medicare for All and the New York Health Act, which would be, like I said, like solid blows to capital and in New York State and beyond, and the Tax the Rich campaign, which benefits, you know, education and childcare and hospital funding, all of these different things. I look around, and not only are they great organizers and people with their eye on the ball, it's also the most diverse little group in the chapter. And I'm like, oh my God, it's hilarious. It's hilarious to right. hear that shit. Because it's like, that's exactly what people are looking for. When you want to do socialist organizing, you want to organize around materialist like mass issues. You just do. Mm-hmm. So so it's always been interesting to hear that for me, because I just want to be seen as you know, a Marxist caucus that has its eye on the ball. And this is our first convention. There's still so much that we're figuring out in terms of like leadership, how to prepare for something like this, how to educate, how to agitate. But you know, we're getting there, and I think that that we've all done pretty good work between like tenant, childcare, healthcare organizing. It's just I've been having such a good conversation with you guys. Just shouts out.
Well, for this mental health podcast, I just want to remind y'all that stable mothers and stable childcare workers create stable people. And if you want stable people in your society, you have to provide a stable childhood to every child. And if you care enough to like do this with me, please join Class Unity or find me. I'll like give Max some links. I don't use the internet very much or very well. So, but you should support our resolution. I think if this episode comes out, their state, you still might have the opportunity to sign it. If it comes out before April 1st, if not, I would just like for you to pay attention at convention, see what happens to it, and keep checking out Class Unity's website for articles to come out about it. And I think also, if you're interested in organizing for childcare, it's not too late for you to turn to the DSA, even if you've had bad experiences with it before, because it's a organization that's always going to be changing and always developing. And there's no time but the present to start. And we need a Child Care for All campaign in the United States. It's a shame that there isn't one. That's all.
Woo!
That's right, sister.
I'm sold.
Yeah, heck yeah. So this is Mo, and what I would say is we need to, you know, just basically not take it, lay it down. We need to actually make demands of the class that's benefited, that really has gained a ton of unimaginable wealth from the economic arrangement that we find ourselves in. The income distribution of the last 50 years absolutely needs to be addressed, and we need universal healthcare, we need universal childcare, we need family leave, and we need to assist parents and families of all types. And I think that starts, you know, with organizing, and making these demands. So talk to people who care about the same things that you do. Chances are high that these are deeply felt needs, because we're all struggling under them. And it's a lot better if you're struggling together.
I'm sold.
Yeah.
All right. I'll join Class Unity.
Damn, it was too late for you.
I know. It was such a pleasure talking to the two of you, and Yeah, I mean, I'll talk to you like later, or, like tomorrow.
See you in Slack.
It was see you in Slack and emails or whatever. But yeah, it was so great to hear the two of you talk about Childcare for All and everything else. And also, Sarah, I think maybe I should have said this before, but to me, you're such an inspiration in that whole worker organizing stuff that yourself and your partner are engaged in. And like the, just your like, your sort of run through of that, like how you arrived at the Childcare for All as this universalist thing that could like more broadly get fought for, but your sort of personal story around that and the, I don't know, just the bravery and the struggles that you kind of pushed through and what you'd observed and experienced, and that that had like kind of lit your brain up toward like, whoa, like we need to be fighting for this thing. I think that's super inspiring, and hopefully listeners kind of heard it that way as well. So yeah, thank you guys. Listeners, so if you want to support the podcast, patreon.com/ it's not just in your head, and if you want to email us, give us any loving feedback, hate mail, constructive criticisms, email us at it'snotjustinyourhead@gmail.com, and that's it. By the way, listeners, if you have enjoyed anything you've heard Harriet say in this program, you will definitely enjoy Capitalism Hits Home, which is a solo program that Harriet does through Democracy at Work, which is a worker-owned cooperative that produces other great programs such as Economic Update with Richard Wolff and the Anti-Capitalist Chronicles with David Harvey. I can't recommend enough that everyone also listen to Capitalism Hits Home if you enjoy It's Not Just in Your Head.
Capitalism Hits Home is a sort of broader overhead view. It explores the way that capitalism shapes our personal lives, our psyches, our relationships, our families, and it looks particularly at the sea change in American personal life as all Americans but the top 10 or 20% of Americans have our security and our chance for a future become as precarious as it always was for minorities and families headed by women. It's not just in your head, and Capitalism Hits Home are definitely complementary.
And if listeners would like to check out Capitalism Hits Home, Harriet, where should they go to find it?
Either on YouTube or Democracy at Work or on my own website, harrietfraud.com.